then 24/7 for many years at a time. Do they have a recommended periodic maintenance procedure where it can be changed, all of the tubes after 1.5 years? Did you ever go through procedures like that? I know the 4CX250Bs we had. Let me drop. A lot of them were being used on VHF, UHF, FAA transmitters. And we amateurs used to find 4CX250Bs and 4CX150s at ridiculously good prices at flea markets, because the FAA was simply changing all of those tubes once every year and a half or something like that. I mean, the tube might be good for 5,000 years. So to increase the reliability of the whole system, they were changing them out in some very brief period of time. To K2RYY for any comments, K2RIW in the tech net.
Let me see some air before I reply. 2-4-5-5-4-1-3-2-1-2-3-4-1-2-3-4-1-2-3-4. That's packet breakup. But I know what you're listening to. Packet breakup. My signal is not holding from point to point on IRFP. Not my radio transmitter. Okay. I can understand what the FAA is doing with their thinking and something like that. You know, you're talking about public safety and stuff. Okay, by that I mean stuff working properly, respect public safety. What can I say here about this system here? I've been running it for many, many years. I mean, these transmitters are running for a long time. I do check the tuning when I go up there. If I find my thing is not making the right power, there's only a couple of adjustments I put with PA grid. I wanted to adjust that are around the 8250s, and they really don't change. You can see the peak, the things peak, but they don't change very much at all as far as what they were to before. So I can tell it didn't really pull out of resonance too much at all. It's just it's like the tube is going soft. But at points, the tube itself may not last as long as it looks like. Maybe it's becoming gassy inside or something else going on, where one tube is made out of glass and it has an internal construction inside, the other tube is made out of ceramics, maybe just something different going up between one to the other.
Yeah, the 4CX150 tube is rated to full 500 watts of power output, 500 watts of power input, up to 150 megacycles. Beyond that, at high power, the glass would overheat, and it would eventually create a small hole of melted glass that would suck in, and the vacuum, of course, would be lost. The 4CX250B is almost identical in construction, except the insulator is ceramic instead of glass. Instead of going to 150 megs, it'll go to 500 megs at full power output, full power input. For two reasons. One, the ceramic has got less loss up there, and also the ceramic can tolerate a lot higher temperature. That's a real beautiful tube, 4CX250B. My parallel kilowatt amplifier has put a pair of those tubes in parallel on a very wide piece of strip line. April 1972 and May 1972, QST Magazine. So people, here we are, what now? 35 years later, still using that particular transmitter. And I've always was threatening to come up with a transmitter that used four of those tubes, so that I could run a very conservative 1500 watts peak envelope power in sideband mode. A pair of 4CX250Bs will easily take 1000 watts input and put out close to 700 watts when we drop the Class C service. At 432. But it sure would be nice to have four of those tubes, because the 4CX250Bs in those days could be obtained at flea markets at such beautiful prices. And if you treated the tube correctly, there's a good chance the tube would outlive you, if you know what I mean. But you got to be very careful in how you treat that screen grid, which is kind of delicate. Kind of have some protection circuit on that screen grid, either passive or active. I prefer passive protection. A high series resistor to make sure that the screen grid could not draw too much current, and therefore it couldn't exceed its 12 watts of dissipation. You exceed 12 watts of dissipation on that screen grid, and you can burn it up in a couple of seconds, and the tube becomes fairly useless after that. But the 4CX250Bs, if I could have come up with a transmitter that used four of those tubes, and I was threatening to do that in those days, slip line, four tubes, and the transmitter, believe it or not, would not have been physically larger. I knew of a way to do it, but never got around to doing it. It would have been a very exotic transmitter to have a very clean 1500 watts peak envelope power with no limiting on the spikes on the upward peaks. If you can design your transmitter in such a way that the peak of the voltage in sideband service comes through, boy, does that have the capability of cutting through the noise. A very, very weak signal, which has, 2 dB of what you think is signal-to-noise ratio on your S-meter, might give you 95% copy if it's a clean bit of sideband with the right kind of speech clipping, speech limiting, and without the transmitter giving you flat topping. A transmitter that's got some extra reserve would really be a pleasant thing to listen to. And I'm threatening to do that. I may go back to that and do it. Because I...
Repeater, time out.
I suspect that 4CX250Bs are still inexpensive. Guys are running the more exotic tubes, 8877s and things like this, the tubes that cost $500 a copy. They're running those in order to get high power. With 4CX250Bs on the used market, they used to be numbers like $5, $10, and $15. I don't know what they are today. But four of those are going to be cheaper. So, somebody got a comment on that? Give me a call, letters and name, KQRIW.
W-H-S-C-D-L, got a question.
Go right ahead with your question, Andy. Wait for the beep, and you got it.
If I'm not mistaken, that transmitter, the 8072, is conduction cooled, not air cooled with a fan. Is that correct?
Joe's going to give us some words on that. So be dry, white, white, go ahead, Joe.
I didn't hear the questions from Andy. Andy's talked a little slower into the radio and a little back off the mic slightly.
He wants to know, is 8072, is it a conduction-cooled tube or is it air-cooled tube? You've got a joke.
I would have to say it's air-cooled because it has a blower at one end of the transmitter strip that blows air over the bottom of the transmitter strip, but there's not air being directly coupled over the tube itself, like a blower assembly, like some of your real high-power stuff. And my comment on tubes, different tubes and so forth, I've only run a 4CX250B in a GE PowerMate on low band, which is good for about 330 watts out. The UHF PowerMate I ran a different type of tube, which is called the 4CX300A. I wonder if you've ever had any luck with those or used those at all for anything, Dick. Those are good for about 250 watts out on UHF.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the 300 tube is the one that had this exotic Loctel socket, a twist lock-like socket, and they were much rarer on the surplus market, as I remember. There's also a 4CX350, but the 4CX300A, I think it's the one that's got a real weird-looking socket. You've got to correct me on that one, Joe. Also, in your 8072 tube, no matter how it was cooled, you have reason to believe that it was running at a reasonable NO temperature. It was getting enough cooling by whatever means that it wasn't being overheated and therefore being shortened on its life for that wave. To be to RYY, KQRIW.
Yes, and I'll tell you why. Because normally the transmitter, the transmitter's power supply, or the power supply in general, is cycled on and off when the transmitter goes on or off. But you can also jump a thermal sensing circuit out that comes up by temperature and keeps it running for a length of time. I chose to put a switch and jump that out. I let the fan run time. I don't cycle the fan on and off. So the transmitter always has cold air blowing off across the bottom of it. And it doesn't. I found that it doesn't change or get as hot or quickly in standby mode, because the thing has no cooling in standby. The transmitter strip gets very hot just from the filament voltage heating up the transmitter chassis. And when you know the subject, I have one comment about the subject I brought up last week.
Okay, let me go back to see if Andy got his question answered, and then we'll go to your subject of last week. WHFCDL, K2RIW. Go ahead, Andy.
All right, you answered the question, but I'm curious, is the plate line to that 8072, how is the plate connected to the output network? Is there a clamp that's going around the tube that tightens around the plate, you know, the body of the tube, which is the plate itself? Because the body, I believe, is the plate of the 8072. Is there a clamp that goes around that, you know, along that connects it to the output network and also holds the tube in place? Is that mounted that way?
I'm going to pass it over to Joe in a minute. Andy, you probably already know it, but I'm going to tell you, you're 90% audio, 10% hiss. Just a little bit of hiss in the background. Good sounding audio, though, by the way. How is that anode structure of that 8072? Is that a glass tube, a ceramic tube? Does it have an external anode that has a clamp on it? Or is the anode coming out of the pins on the bottom of that tube? W2RYY, K2RYW, you got it, Joe, wait for the beeps.
Well, the anode is definitely metal. It has this plate assembly that has two screws that go across the tube itself on each side, and then one screw on the top that attaches to a block assembly within the transmitter. That's where the DC supply comes in, and the RF is coupled out of this assembly area to a coupling loop that goes to two output controls. There's also I guess you'd call it like a flapper capacitor, something that can change physically space-wise against the plate tuned area or away from it slightly, and that's how they get the plate tuning from of these things.
You got it, Andy. For any further comments, W2CDL, K2IW.
Yeah, the body of the tube is the anode. If I'm not mistaken, there's supposed to be a good amount of heat sink compound between the plate and the anode and the clamp that's clamping it, the anode clamp, to dissipate the heat. And because I'm visualizing what this looks like, because it's been a while since I've seen one, and I think you got to make sure there's enough heat sink compound on that. I think they've had some trouble with that thing. Even though you have a blower in there, I don't think that air circulation was enough. I remember seeing a bulletin on that plate clamp has to be well dissipated heat wise to the plate line to prevent the tube from having a shorter life. So that's my comment on that, Dick. Back to you.
Over to you, Joe, for any further comments.
I believe I do have some sort of compound that I've used that it helps dissipate the heat, and it's like a grayish looking type of stuff. And I've used that on all the transmitter strips when I put one to replace the tubes, and I also make sure that the screen ring is bent in so it touches the tube very nicely on the screen portion of the tube itself. That's about it. That's all I have for this particular subject. Now, can I give you a comment about the subject I was talking about last week?
You've got it, Joe. Wait for the beep.
Sorry about all the Vegas running with the feedback here. I had to shut everything else off here so I don't have too much echo. Last week I was talking about using my service monitor to test a duplexer, and you were telling me about the leakage and using the New England method and so forth. Let me make a comment about that. The service monitor I use is not an HB608, which is from like the 1950s era as far as test equipment goes. I use something a lot more modern than that. I put a 50-ohm terminator on the output of the TR port. I had my HT about 2 feet, 2 linear feet from the signal generator. Turned the signal generator up on the output of my repeater. At 0 dBm, I did not, repeat, did not hear any signal in my HT. As soon as it reached down and cracked the 50-ohm load off the output of the TR jack on the service monitor, it came into my radio full quality. So that proves that my service monitor is not leaking RF. That was my comment to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm not at all surprised that a service monitor, which often is used to align a duplexing filter, would have to have very good shielding. So you don't have to use the so-called New England technique, putting the signal generator in the backyard on the end of 15 feet of cable, in order to get rid of the problem of the leakage of the cabinet of the signal generator, giving you false alarms when you're aligning a duplexing filter. So I know I've had some discussions with other people during this week about using a sniffer by way of putting a quarter inch or a half inch diameter loop at the end of a piece of coaxial cable, semi-rigid or braided, double braided RG223. A loop at the end used in the receive mode can find leakages from a transmitter, but where you're worried about leakages getting into a receiving device that's looking for a very weak signal during duplex or tune-up, a strong signal applied to that sniffer used in the transmit mode held near various junctions, connectors, cables, and whatever of a duplexer, and you're twisting that sniffer because it's got a very directional pattern to it. So you're twisting it as you're putting it near various objects. And so if there was a specific point of leakage, a particular connector, a particular cable, that sniffer used as a transmitter, when you put 10 watts into it from a very well-shielded transmitter in the backyard after a long piece of cable, double-shielded cable, that could give you some strong hints as to if there's a leakage somewhere in the system, where is the leakage coming from? So should you test the system in the receive mode with a sniffer or a transmit mode with a sniffer? I think the answer might be do both.
Repeater, time out.
As I was starting to say, I think the answer might be do both. Because depending on the situation, one could give you information which is hard to get with the other. Over to you, Joe. The B2LYY, K2LIW in the tech net.
The other one I was using didn't hear me. I did try that. I did take one of my double shielded cables, the more flexible cables, on RG142, which is double shielded cables. And I did create a very small loop and about it, like 3/8 inch long loop that went back to the ground. And it did do what you suggested, and it did prove out that one of the cables, as I get near it, it seemed to be the most sensitive right near the end connector junction at the cable itself. Of course, these are crimp connectors, and what I did was I picked the cable off, and I found I could move the connector very slightly on the end of that cable, proving that something was wrong with that connection. It wasn't supposed to be. But those cables were handed to me by somebody else. It was supposed to be good, and I didn't like the quality of the cables to begin with, what they looked like. So I had new cables on order, I'm working on with this particular receiver, and it'll be in within about a week or so, then I can do the test and get back to you with the results. Give me 2-4, bye.
Jack, give me a second. Let me see if I can find out where this track of work is coming from. Okay, you want me to just stand by, Eric?
Just hang out for about a minute.
Roger, Roger.
Packing packet loss is really annoying. Sometimes you have to disconnect your node from the reflector and reconnect again, and it just gets reconnected to another path, and it solves the problem. You know, on a computer, you would not notice this. A computer would just simply send the data from point A to point B, and you wouldn't care if it took another 50 milliseconds to get there. But when you're transmitting VoIP, which is what the RF system is, it becomes real annoying sometimes. It chops off pieces of words and things like that because some of the packets don't get reassembled as quickly as you'd like them to go. Point to point.
Thank you. thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link clear.
So, I don't know if you realize it, but I have input into the reflector itself, and I can see what's actually going on beyond just making things so. So if I understand correctly, Eric, you're visualizing with your instrumentation the link dropout period. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I can actually call up the number of this packet, so.
Yeah, no, this is all UDP what's going on. There's
some programs that are helpful if you've got the right place to connect it to.
So do you believe you have the ability to make an improvement tonight, Eric? Should we stand by while you make an improvement?
Yeah, I'm typing. Give me a second.
Roger.
Node number 4148. Link active. Node.
One, two, three, four, five. I don't hear the signal, but I know what's ever happening. Point between my node to your node, correct?
I'm hearing dropouts.
Node number 4148. Link clear.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
From the stuff that I see, it looks like, what am I hearing here? It looks like not the connection between in New England, it's the connection between him and the server. I mean, we don't realize it, but we're actually all utilizing a server that's in Vancouver.
Eric, is there a way of reestablishing that server in Vancouver that could give better service?
Just from my end.
Okay. Make a sample transmission, Joe. Let's see if we hear an improvement.
Okay, now I'm going to the 9126 reflector over to your node, which is also put in the 9126. You still having packet dropouts?
I'm hearing the exact same amount of dropouts. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, I'm going to hook this up to 9125. Let's see if we hear it from you. I don't think so, but I'm going to find out.
I am. So on IRLP, if you want to compare it to TC2, I think so.
Well, if you put it directly on node to node and through the reflector, it might be my ISP provider that's doing it to me. There's nothing I can do about that, really. It is what it is.
I've experienced in the past, sometimes just repeating a node or repeating a router, could open to a situation. I've tried that already. And this is KC2, I'm also on IRLP. If you don't hear any packet drop on me,
I'm hearing no dropout on Jonathan's signal. Over to you, Eric.
I'm going to beat a dead horse here. Yeah, it's very possible that my service provider is not giving me the quality tonight. Something's wrong with the system. Who knows what? It is what it is. If the guys are coming in fine with the reflector to the repeater, then it's got to be my node into the my IP provider. That's where the problem is. I can reboot that later.
Joe. Give me one more transmission in which you back off from the microphone a whole lot. Give me a whole lot less audio And give me another brief transmission, Joe.
No audio at all. A little bit of audio. Quite a ways away from your radio. It's not my portable radio. I'm using a Motorola EX600. It does not over DVA anything. My link radio that I'm talking directly into is not full frequency or input or something like that. You're like, gonna have to listen to myself fighting. I don't hear myself looking up on this thing. It's received speaker audio whatsoever. So it's got to be my RLC node, the going out to wherever. It's got to be disturbed in the back of you. There's something in the way that breaks something up from time to time. It doesn't like, you know, high-level audio, so to speak. I guess the packet level changes and stuff like that. Now, I'm not producing for very much audio. It's not breaking up, correct?
It's not an audio issue. I'm seeing air is coming into the server. It's coming from either him or his ISP or somewhere along the way. Yeah, I had the mistake of thinking that it was only the peaks of audio giving the dropout. Absolutely not. You went down 6 or 8 dB in audio, and I heard the exact same amount of dropout on the very low audio. So it's not peak. There's periodic dropout of that internet data, and regardless of audio amplitude, I don't know who wants to pick it up, KQRIW listening.
Yeah, I'm trying. You really should reboot the node and the router. I mean, it happens. Stuff like this. AC2, I think.
That's what I think Eric just did, is reboot. I think he rebooted twice. KQEJ, KQIW.
Coming from him directly.
Yeah, actually, we disconnected and reconnected the process anyhow. It's not us. And if you listen to 9125, you don't hear any dropouts in there, really, at all. Just listen to 9125 and tell me if you hear any dropouts. K2RIWK2J. Okay. What I heard from you just now, Eric, absolutely no dropouts. Should I go to 975, 375 in order to see if there's any dropouts? Is that what you're recommending? K2EJ, K2RIW? No, I'm suggesting you listen to 449125. I have it connected. Okay. Sure enough. Go over to this way. Okay. I'm now listening to 449125 with a great big delay. So, Joe, give me a transmission. WA2RYY, K2RIW in the check name.
WA2RYY, test 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm listening to both of you at the same time for myself. I say 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Yeah, I hit drop out from time to time. Every once in a while, it just takes part of my speech to make the total go away. Yeah, I can reboot my nose to see if it solves the problem.
Joe, if you get a chance, do a trace route and see what your connection looks like.
I don't know how to do that in Linux language.
The same thing as with us. Actually, I think it's one letter. It's C-R-A-B-R-C. As you already know, I was hearing dropouts on Joe on 1249. That's because he's originating the dropouts. Roger.
And that's like command 449125. Now you don't hear any dropouts at all. So I'm going directly into UHF through the node and back out the node through the reflector. Now it's fine, right?
Give me a repeat on that, Joe, now that I'm listening to 449. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Yeah, I'm going directly in on UHF on 449125, in and out to you, the entire loop, and I don't hear any packet problems. So you notice this location is operating fine. So I know that's doing it.
Roger, Dodger, no dropouts that time.
Okay, enough beating a dead horse. You can go on to the next subject or next guy in line.
Boop. Boop.
lost connection here temporarily. For some reason, my little check didn't want to make contact. Okay. When it comes to crimp connectors on the jumper cables for a UHF duplexer, I've seen a lot of grief on those things. The good news about a crimp connector is it's nice and fast. The bad news is that they've got a couple of failure modes that are kind of nasty. A real UG21 connector with its collar properly installed on double shielded flexible cable can do a beautiful job, or a semi-rigid cable can do a beautiful job on a repeater for those U-shaped jumper cables. But a buddy of mine had a UHF repeater with crimp connectors, and I was at a location where I had to help him keep that repeater on the air. And it seems like every 2 days he called me up and said, please go over there and wiggle those cables. We're getting some funny noises. And I would wiggle the cables and the problem would go away for another 2 days. And when he finally replaced those crimp connectors, the problem got a hell of a lot better. So leaky crimp connectors, and by way of the sniffer used in the transmit mode, I think you have confirmed that the crimp connector is the source of the grief of the true Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm called back on a claim that they can hear me properly. Yes, yes, it seemed to be coming from one cable at one particular junction specifically, but it's funny, it seems to create standing waves along the cabling itself where you can move the sniffer away from that particular joint and then you can hear it come back later on and hit another point to the cable. So it's kind of funny, almost used like a standing wave type of effect. I don't like crimp connectors, I never did. They're good for mobile service, for putting mobile connectors on mobile wires and things like that, but I don't use for repeater service. All my cables, my repeater, all clamp connectors, every single one of them, point to point. I don't believe in crimp connectors on repeaters.
Yeah, I also have a lot of skepticalness when it comes to crimp connectors on outdoor antennas, because there's a zillion ways that the moisture can get into that crimp. So unless you've done some pretty serious weatherproofing techniques with all kinds of goo, I don't trust the crimp connectors. It may take you 10 minutes to install each individual UG21 type N connector on the end of your cable, and it's a pain. But if that connector is going to give you the next 10 years of service, as far as I'm concerned, it's an extremely good investment. A crimp connector, you put on the crimp connector in a few seconds, but in a year or less you might have grief, so that's a false economy from my point of view. And once you get leakage in a system that's down to like numbers of 109 or 90 dB or 100 dB of isolation between the transmit mode and the receive port, transmit port and receive, we start getting those kind of numbers. And one connector is doing leakage and signal is now crawling down the outside of that cable. We get all kinds of crazy. Let me drop it. You get all kinds of crazy standing wave effects where as you run your hand along that cable, there are specific points where the apparent leakage will increase and decrease. You move your body around that system. Some of the signal on that cable is radiating like it's an antenna, hitting your body and reflecting back. It's not too different from what happens when I put my handy jockey on the plastic shelf in my bathroom, and I get the best reception on a particular repeater when the handy jockey is horizontal, even though the repeater itself is vertical. And as I move around in the room on this weak signal that I'm listening to, the signal will go through peaks and valleys and drop out. Because of the reflection off of me, even though I am 5 feet or so from the handy jockey, I'm 5 feet from the handy jockey, and as I move forward or back a half a foot, the signal will come and go because of the reflection off my body. Once you radiate the signal into an environment, it reflects, that radio signal will reflect off of every single object in that environment. Whether it's an insulator or a conductor, it's reflecting off every single object. And so by way, you might ask now, how is the signal getting from the repeater, that in my case is 20 miles away or 15 miles away, how is it getting to my handy jockey? And the answer is by a nearly infinite number of paths. almost every single object in the environment that's in the vicinity between me and that repeater 15 miles away, 20 miles away. Every one of those objects is giving you some amount of reflection. Let me drop. So there are many thousands of signals getting to the rubber duck antenna on my handy-talkie sitting on that plastic shelf in my bathroom. There are thousands of individual signals getting there. The composite of all those signals is the vector sum of all those. In other words, you take the amplitude of every one of those thousands of signals to those thousands of individual paths of reflecting off of water towers and trees and ground and houses and everything else, buildings. Take every one of those individual signals, with the phase angle, add them all up in a voltage manner, a vector voltage manner, at my rubber duck, and that's what my handy-talkie is seeing. And so, one of those paths is a reflection off of my body. And as I move around, that reflection goes in phase and out of phase. And therefore, the signal goes into peaks and valleys coming out of my handy-talkie. All of this strange stuff. Anybody further questions or comments on what we've discussed so far? Give me a call that is right now.
UPS, why don't you get in?
Okay, UPS, K2 Uncle Papa Sierra. I presume you're in Pennsylvania by now, heading west. You've got it, Richard. Thank you for relaying the message. I was listening to everything you were saying on 2585 when you were telling everybody about my grief with my flat tire. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra, somewhere in Pennsylvania. K2RIW, you got it, Rich.
I messed up. He's not making it in, but give me a second.
Roger, Roger.
Okay, KPBS, try it again.
Okay, that didn't go through, Eric?
Yeah, I was changing some settings before, and I killed the echoing audio by mistake.
Now you're coming through. When you said you didn't come through before, you're coming through beautifully now, Rich. And thank you for relaying the message. And I heard everything you guys were saying. While I was driving home after my tire got replaced, with the help of three hams, three very muscular hams, that had to jump up and down on one end of a star wrench while the other guys were lifting the other end of the star wrench, and full human power on both ends of the star wrench were required to loosen those 5 volts. That guy who used his impact wrench on that automobile tire rim, boy, he did a job on us. It took a couple of years for it to show up, but boy, did it show up today. UPS, K2LIW. You got it there, Rich. Thank you.
So, impact wrenches that are air-driven usually is around 150 to 200 foot-pounds. Most slugs need between 80 and 100 foot-pounds.
If you leave the impact wrench running long enough, each individual impact will move that lead another 1 degree. Leave the impact wrench on long enough, you can shear each one of those studs. And I've seen it happen. K2UPS, K2RIW.
W2RIW, I was comment.
Rich first. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, first of all, you're welcome for helping me out before. And obviously, could have used regular clicking to get those lug nuts off. But the that reference also refers to what I think might be causing Joe's packet losses. Tonight was the premiere, the season premiere of Game of Thrones. Extremely popular TV show. A lot of people stream it. They're not necessarily watching it on their home TV, but they're on their portable devices streaming it. And last year there was they crashed the server, I think, at HBO Go because there was so many people hooked up. So Joe might find that he has his services back to normal either later on tonight or tomorrow.
That could be very good information, Rich. KE2EJ for comments on that. Go ahead, Rich. Eric.
That's entirely possible. Depends upon whether you're on Fios or you're on cable vision, because they cluster nodes differently, whereas cable vision tends to fill the clusters that are less than 1,000 users, and it has limited bandwidth, so if, you know, if he's on one of those clusters and they're all watching it, then he's banging into it. It's not his fault, it's just the way it is. Now, Joe wanted to make a comment, maybe on the impact wrench. An overused impact wrench, misused, can really do an excess tightening job. You heard my story about what I've done with two automobile mechanics when I handed them my star wrench and said, let's see you loosen that bolt. And they never will pick up the star wrench when I do that. W2RYY, K2RIW.
I spoke with a friend of mine about this exact stuff that you're talking about, and he said something that was kind of amazing. I didn't realize they make tools this way that have this kind of power. The company called, I think it's Ryobi, if I pronounce it right, they make a whole bunch of different types of drills, impact units, battery operated. He says they now make impact guns that are battery operated that have the same kind of foot-pound force as the guy we use inside the gas station. Powered off an air hose. You might want to check in to get yourself one of those things, type of things. So this happens again to you, and you got a bozo mechanic that insists on using 250 foot pounds of torque on your lug nuts. You may be out in the woods someplace, and having a real difficult issue getting your lug nuts off. That happens again, but you may want to check in and get one of these portable guns to keep in your car with you. If it happens again, at least you can get the thing off by yourself.
Whenever I've had tires replaced, and I tell them be careful about over-tightening those lugs, what they will often do is they add an extra extender. In other words, it's a length of rod in between the impact wrench and the socket, which is about 6 inches long. The springiness of that extender will stop the impact wrench from creating these ridiculously high torques. Once they put that extender in there, the problem goes away. But an air-operated impact wrench used directly on the socket on the lug of a wheel, if they go 3 seconds too long, my goodness, can they create grief. If they stop at exactly the right time, it comes out okay. But each individual impact of that wrench, and it's probably doing 30 impacts per second, some crazy number, is moving that lug 1 degree, so to speak. If you do it long enough, you will shear that stud. There's no limit to what that thing will do. If the length between the impact wrench and the socket is zero, there's no limit to how many foot-pounds it can go to. It can go way beyond what you can create with any reasonable torque wrench. I have on a couple of occasions put a great big long piece of pipe on a star wrench, extra 3 feet of pipe, steel pipe, and then use that to apply the turning torque to remove a stuck lug. And you're right at the threshold of creating destruction of your star wrench when you do that. Anybody have any comments on all the above? Give me a call, letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW.
Hey, Eric. I know the problem exactly that you're talking about. I actually have a battery-operated impact wrench, and I also have a what's called an impact screwdriver for things that are really tough. Basically, it's an unscrewing device that you hit with a hammer. But when I pull out of Goodyear, I usually pull out my torque wrench and see how tight they made them. Usually they're over-tightened, and I adjust them correctly. I have a really long, long-handled wrench that does the job. But now that I have the impact wrench, I use that. But the battery-operated impact wrench that I have actually has a setting so that you can control the torque of it. So, there you go. K2RIW, K2J.
KC1SAM.
KC1SAM, recognized.
S-A-M. Okay, I also own an impact wrench. I think it's a Sears brand, or maybe I bought it at the Harbor Freight, and it runs 110 volts, and it was miles away at home. And see, do I own an inverter that would power that at 110 volts from the automobile? I don't think so. It probably would be unhappy with that voltage. KC1SAM. Please start up with your name, sir. And then tell us your comment on all of the above. K2RIW, Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick.
Yeah, Roger. We're talking 1346. Name here is Sam. I'm up in Connecticut. And my comment on the lead nuts is that I run, up here, I run two sets of top summer for making, in the winter I go up to Vermont, northern Vermont, and I like four-sided snows. Down here, summer, I don't hate them. So you tell them to hand-tighten them when they put them on. I had a similar problem many, many, many years ago. And from now on, I go in, I get the tires changed over in the fall, in the summer, and I just have them hand-tighten them with one of the star wrenches, and I don't have the problem. I haven't had a flat, but I hope I won't have the problem. Back over to you.
Yeah, very good, Sam. Hand tightening, of course, is a good way of doing it. But if you're in one of these great big garages that's changing 1,000 tires per day, so to speak, and they're doing it by mass production, sometimes they're reluctant to do that. As long as they use that extender rod between the torque wrench and the socket, which acts like a spring, that will limit the amount of foot-pounds that the impact wrench is capable of putting onto your particular lug nut. So that's another solution. And yes, before you leave the place that just installed your lug nuts on your automobile, at your service station, to get out your star wrench and see if you're able to move them before you drive away is a very smart thing to do. Well, this is my wife's car. I wasn't there during the installation. And if I was real smart, I would have tested it immediately when she came home with the automobile, but I wasn't smart enough to do that, in which case I would have driven right back to that place saying, you're going to correct this. Because on a rainy night, in the dark, when I've got to change a flat tire, and if I can't move the lug nut because of what you guys have done, I'm going to be using some pretty strong, salty language describing your activity. So that's something to worry about. I suspect that a significant percentage of the automobiles out there right now have lugs that are so tight that with the hand-operated tools that are supplied in the trunk of your car, you might not be able to change that tire. Since many people never change a tire themselves, they take it to a service station, they don't know that this problem exists. And with any further questions or comments, please give me a call.
Repeater, time out.
WS2N.
Just give me your comments right now. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead, Paul.
Dick, you call it a star wrench. I was carrying the cross wrench in my car, which is very good. Star wrench, I'm not familiar with. What do you mean by that?
That wrench that's got four sockets in four directions. It's got two rods at right angles. You call it a cross wrench. A hell of a lot of people call that a star wrench. So in the environment I live in, my friends call it a star wrench. A cross wrench is obviously, maybe that's a more popular name for it, as far as I know. WS2N, K2IW, you got a ball.
A wrench.
Very good. I just wanted to clarify. Okay. Yeah, I always carry a cross wrench, or what you call it, the star wrench. But I always have a one-inch piece of pipe with me as well. You know, 2.5 foot long, 1-inch steel pipe, schedule 40, and that really helps. You really need that. Back to you.
Yeah, somebody wanted to give us a comment but the transmitter didn't pick up fast enough, so all I heard is the word wrench. The star wrench or the cross wrench that we use today required a 270-pound man jumping on the high side of the star wrench at the same time that another 220-pound man was lifting the other end of the star wrench with all the thrust, all the force he could create. So you had one man jumping on one side, another man lifting on the other side, and I could tell by the way the wrench was winding up, we're coming very close to the failure torque on that wrench, and whether or not the socket end was going to blast apart, or whether the welding between the two pieces that are crossed to each other were about to come apart, they were twisting. That's what was required in this case to make this thing come apart. K2RAW listening. So without the help of those four hands in that parking lot, without calling a service station with a remotely operatable impact wrench, or taking my vehicle back to their service station without some serious other hardware, those lugs were not going to come off that car. Sad situation. Now, there's one more wheel in that car that I ought to check. Guarantee it's got the exact same problem. And so, yes, in my car I do carry an extra piece of pipe that can apply more torque. Because just jumping on any of these wrenches creates a very peculiar torque, as well as getting a radial force as well as a axial force simultaneously. With a very long piece of pipe, you can convert everything into an axial force, which is the one that you really want. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me a call, that is K2RAW. Automobiles are fun. Paul, you had a comment you wanted to make for us. WS2N, K2RAW. You got it, Paul. And at the end of your comment, you probably can begin your space report number 259. WS2N, K2RAW.
Oh, okay. During the week, I read an article about some girl that got herself electrocuted and actually killed her in New Mexico, and using a cell phone in a bathtub. Apparently, it was being charged. I heard the report, and I went to her. They actually had a video of a news report talking about it, and they said it was plugged into the bathroom wall, and while it was charging, and they don't know if it was grabbed, to be pulled into, you know, they don't know if she was plugging it in or if she just grabbed it, if it was already plugged in. But I thought it was odd with today's phone, you know, the voltage is low. You might have a wall wart on the power end, sometimes going into a USB, some of the older phones still have a power, you know, low voltage power going from the wall wart into the phone. Maybe it's that. They weren't very clear. But I thought all bathrooms were supposed to have a GFI, ground force interrupter. And they did not say one way or the other whether it had one or not. But don't you believe if it did have it, it would have stopped that no matter what? Anytime I read about GFIs, they shut things off real quick. Back to you, sir.
D2HUC with a comment.
HUC recognized. W82, I think it is HUC. The ground fault interrupter would have protected her, because by the time it hits numbers like 10 or 20 milliamps, it's already tripping. And you would think that the 7.5 volts or whatever it is that's charging your lithium battery in a cell phone would never give you grief, you would think. That's on the assumption that the transformer in the wall wart had a real primary and secondary and was isolated. However, it is quite possible that the manufacturer of that wool wart for that cell phone charger was skimping on wiring. He wanted to make things simple, and therefore he made a auto transformer, a cap. So it's only got a primary winding with a cap on it. It's got a 12-volt cap on 120-volt winding, so to speak. Just one winding on the transformer. No isolation between input 120-volt line and the 7 volts of output, or whatever it is that charges the cell phone, lithium-ion battery. And so that combined with a socket that's not properly wired. Let me think now. I'd like to believe that the wall wart has a wide and a narrow blade so that you can't plug it in the wrong way. Maybe it didn't have that either. But the lack of the GFI in the bathroom, of course, is lethal. All modern bathrooms should have a GFI on every socket in that bathroom. Let me drop a quick. My house was built in 1957. And the one socket in my bathroom is in a very inconvenient place. It's on the fluorescent light that's on the top of the mirror in the bathroom. Very inconvenient place. But there is no GFI there. So if I was foolish enough to plug in with an extension cord a wall wart that's charging my cell phone while I'm sitting in the bathtub, and that would be a very dangerous condition. If I was a smart guy, I would make sure there's a GFI in my bathroom. I don't run any electrical appliances in my bathroom. When I charge my electric shaver, it is done with its wall wart in another room of the house for a whole bunch of reasons. In fact, the socket, there's something very intermittent on that socket that's on the fluorescent light in my bathroom. So for a whole bunch of reasons, I never use it, and that's the only socket in the bathroom. WA2 HUC, I think it's W2. K2RAW, go right ahead.
KD2 HUC, Kilo Delta 2. And to answer Paul's question, I actually read a follow-up report in one of the electrical forums I belong to. It turns out that, no, the particular circuit did not have a GFCI installed in the bathroom. But when they examined the young lady, she had burns on one of her hands, and the report concluded that she had reached and contacted frayed wiring on the extension cord. So it was not the phone nor the charging circuit that electrocuted her, but was actually direct to the 110 line that that did her in, according to the report that I read. I think it was either this morning or last night. So that was the latest information on that. KD2HUC, back to net.
That's very good information, Steve. Where did that incident occur? Was that in the New York City area? You got it, Steve?
No, I believe the young lady was in New Mexico visiting her father or something like that. It was in the news article that they had posted. So it was out in the Southwest.
Whenever a human being is in water, whether it be the water that's pouring into your basement during a Hurricane Sandy incident, very dangerous condition, and you go wading in your basement in order to recover your valuables, your check stubs and your photographs, whatever. If a socket in your basement touches that water that's pouring into your basement, and your body, even if it's just the lower legs of your body, are in that water, you are in an extremely dangerous condition. Even though your hands do not touch any electrical appliance, you can easily develop a voltage gradient in that fluid, because in the case of Sandy, the fluid that was pouring into people's basements, in some cases, was salt water, a highly conductive substance. Salt water has a conductivity of around 2 ohms per meter, I think it is. So the water, which, by the way, is the same conductivity as human blood. So the salt water, there's a whole lot of people who appear to drown during Hurricane Sandy in their basement. I'm convinced that a high percentage of those ground drownings were electrocution. So you got to really worry about electrical power in the vicinity of the fluid. There are people who went swimming at a dock where people have party boats parked. And those party boats are sometimes using short-time power, short-size power.